All right. So, Lindsay Clancy and associated ills and problems and challenges. So, there's something that Pearly Things, Pearl Davis said recently, that like only 1 to 2% of women are marriageable. And I would say, what, I married 3% of the women I dated. Or something like that. Maybe 2%. So maybe she's not far off. And, you know, whether that's more of a modern phenomenon or not is sort of an interesting question. But it is hard for men to process why women do what they do, why they have the approaches that they do. It is hard for men to understand the degree of hive mind, of Borg, so to speak, that women are susceptible to and manifest. It's hard for us to understand. Particularly high testosterone men, or men who are physically strong, which is sort of two sides of the same coin. But as a whole, it's very hard for men to understand this. So there was a study that came out recently that over 60% of male psychology professors said that the truth was important and even more important than social equity or things like that. And a little over 40% of women felt the same way or were willing to report the same way. And that is, of course, a little shocking to men, in that for women to say social equality, racial or ethnic or we can't even say gender equality because women don't mind that when women are overrepresented. But that equality is more important than truth. It's hard for men to understand that. Now, the balance between male and female is that men should definitely be more sensitive to the effects of inequality on others, for sure. I mean, let's take an example of a man who has the bad habit of being an obnoxious or abrasive winner. So let's say the man is playing golf or tennis or squash, and, you know, every time he wins, he's like, "Suck it, loser!" You know, he just gets really obnoxious and annoying when he wins. Then his girlfriend or his wife or his mother or sister would probably say something like, "You know, that's a little obnoxious. Like, don't do that. That's just going to cause annoyance and blowback. It's kind of rude." And so that sensitivity is important. That sensitivity is important. Men and women have carved off aspects of a well-rounded personality and given it to each other. My wife is concerned about things that I'm not particularly concerned about, but that I accept as important. So, I mean, a sort of typical example is, men just want furniture that's comfortable and not necessarily immediately dangerous. You know, it doesn't have like rat's nests in it or something like that. And women don't really want that as much, right? So when I was a bachelor, I had, you know, tables that were being thrown out by other people or discarded by other people. I had a futon from my student days, you know, just a wide variety of things. I didn't really care whether they hung together or anything like that. And so I was happy with all of that, and that was fine. That was fine. My wife cares about things looking good and hanging together, and she's willing to spend more money to end up with, you know, good furniture that is pleasing and nice and all this, that, and the other. And that makes, you know, kind of sense. That makes sense to me as a whole. That's a good idea. Sure. It's not that important to me until she gets her way, so to speak. And then it's like, yeah, this is nicer. This is nicer. And so sort of local aesthetics and things that are pleasing to the eye and so on are important. Having a nice home that is calming and soothing and pleasant is a positive thing. So I don't particularly care about it, but she's right to push for it. So that is a way in which the completeness of my mind is offloaded to my wife, and together we make a pleasant home. So, for instance, in my business career, and of course, also, as you know, in my social media career, such as it is, I have to be willing to be disagreeable, unpopular. I have to be willing to laugh in the face of outrage and so on, which not that many women are comfortable with. So my wife likes people to get along. She likes a comfortable, nice, and pleasant home, which is a good thing. And one of the ways that we pay for that is by me being willing to be disagreeable and to provoke rage or anger or hostility. Not provoke it, but that's sort of a natural consequence of telling the truth, is that, you know, when you tell the truth, well, obviously, liars get angry and frustrated and upset. You know, there was a guy many years ago who had some balloon ride that was supposed to be sort of terrible or bad or negative or something like that. And then his son blurted out that it was kind of all staged and planned in an interview. And of course, the dad was quite upset and angry at him, in the same way that if there's a killer in the house and his wife tells a policeman who's over where the bodies are buried, he's going to be angry at her. So, you know, when people are doing wrong things, they don't like it when people tell the truth, obviously, about those wrong things. So I am willing, as a whole, in some instances, but, you know, these are general patterns, I'm willing to be more disagreeable than my wife, and my wife focuses on making the home pleasant. And obviously, these are just two examples. It's not the sum total, but these are sort of two examples. And I didn't care if plates matched, right? I mean, if you're a man, you know, does it keep the toasted cheese from burning my testicles? That's really the major plan for plates. And plates that don't match are willing to do that, no problem. And that's totally fine, right? So then what I have to do when I get married is I have to get rid of all my bachelor stuff, and we have to have plates that match and cutlery that matches, not just stuff that you picked up along the way that you have no idea about. And again, totally fine, no problem with it. It's a good thing. So when I'd have people over for a dinner party, we'd all sit around a plastic table on mismatched plates and mismatched cups. And now when we have a dinner party, it's beautiful. Like, honestly, it is absolutely lovely. I never in my wildest dreams would imagine that having a dining room table that seats 10 people was a good investment when I could buy yet another computer or microphone or headset or something like that. I never in a million years would imagine that's a good investment. However, when we do have people over for a dinner party or something like that, it is beautiful what my wife does. Is and she's an amazing hostess. So what's happened in nature is that where things can be outsourced, then they are. And what that means, though, is that men and women need each other to become whole. Male nature without female restraint is fascism. Female nature without male restraint is heavy socialism or communism, another form of egalitarian totalitarianism. So on the far right, with fascism, it is excessive competition and no empathy and eugenics and all other kinds of terrible evil government programs, because it is raw meritocracy combined with the power of the state, combined with male nature, unmitigated by female sympathies and a desire for egalitarianism. I mean, if you can imagine, you know, there are kids, you know, 6, 4, and 2 years old, and there's a man who just lays out some food and says, go for it, may the best kid win, right? Okay, so that would not be very fair to the two-year-olds, right? So the mother would say, no, we can't do it that way, right? That's means the six-year-old's going to get more food, the four-year-old's going to get less food, and the two-year-old is not going to get much food at all. And, you know, at least within reasonable bounds, the two-year-old needs the food more than the four-year-old because they're growing more, and the four-year-old needs the food even more than the six-year-old, though not in equal portions. And so the egalitarianism would be to say, you know, we have a 2,000 calories, we have 2,000 calories, and we should share them equally between the 15-year-old boy and the 10-year-old girl, right? But the 10-year-old girl needs far fewer calories. If you talk to parents of teenage boys, you know, the teenage boys are like, can I get a slice of pizza? It's like, well, dinner's in half an hour, but I'm hungry, right? It's just like throwing, it's like firing groceries into space or taking an entire dépanneur and throwing it down a well. The calorie requirements for growing boys are prodigious. I remember this from being hungry as a teenager. So excessive egalitarianism, right, which is the communist, everyone has to end up equal, is also destructive. What is a good combination is the meritocracy of the free market combined with charity. And you can see this, of course, with very wealthy divorcees like Mackenzie Bezos and Melinda Gates and so on, that their husbands made a lot of money through raw meritocracy. And then the women, when they get a hold of the money, what do they want to do? Well, they want to diminish inequality by taking the money made by their husbands and applying it to those who are less fortunate, so that those who are less fortunate become slightly more fortunate, and those who are more fortunate, such as themselves, become less fortunate, and so on. So the men make the money with raw meritocracy, and then the women disperse the money according to the ideals of egalitarian charity. And what that means is that the price of the goods their husbands made were overpriced, because now there's so much money for the women to give a bunch away to charity, which is not what the customers would have wanted. The customers would rather have kept their own money rather than give the money to Jeff Bezos, who then has to give it to Mackenzie Bezos, who then gives it to a bunch of usually hyper-left-wing causes that plot the destruction of everything that the customers treasure, right? You wouldn't want that. Like, would you, if there was a little check market, right? If there was a little check mark on Amazon or some other places that said, you can pay 5 or 10% more, and this will be automatically donated to the Communist Party. And I'm not saying that Mackenzie Bezos donates to the Communist Party. I'm just using an extraneous hyperbolic example to sort of like, if there was a little check box that said, oh, this thing is $30, hit this check box so that you can pay an extra $3 that will then go into the coffers of hyper-leftist organizations or whatever charity, right? Then people would say, well, no, I would rather donate to my own charity or keep my money for my own kids or my own family or something like that. So anyway, this is just kind of how it works out. So men making money in the free market and then women distributing the profits of the man's income through either, you know, pleading, nagging, or gaining access to the resources in divorce. For men to make the money in a meritocracy is the equivalent of hunting or farming. And then they give their resources to their wives, and their wives then use those resources to reduce inequality between the children. Right? So the man goes out and hunts five rabbits, and then he gives the five rabbits to his wife, who then makes a meal and makes sure that each child gets an appropriate amount of food, right? That's pretty clear, right? An appropriate amount of food. And that's natural. Men go out and produce through meritocracy. And then what women do, of course, is the women end up taking those resources and reducing inequality through force, right? Through force. If you have an older child who's really hungry and a younger child who's too small to get his or her own food, right? Let's say you've got a 10-year-old boy who's really hungry and a 4-year-old girl who's hungry, then according to just force doctrine, like according to sort of the facts of force, the eldest, like the child, the older child, can absolutely take as much food as he wants from the 4-year-old girl. And that, of course, women's instincts rail against that for, you know, like entirely rational and sensible and evolutionarily important reasons. The mom cannot allow the 10-year-old to just grab whatever food he wants at the expense of the 4-year-old, because that means that the 4-year-old will be undernourished. And being undernourished is very bad in general, but it's certainly very bad throughout most of our evolution when kids continually got sick and they needed energy for their immune system to fight bacteria, viruses, infections, and so on. And so the difference between a certain amount of calories and fewer calories was very often the difference between life and death, right? So now a child deficient in calories to be really harmed would have to get close to starvation or starve to death. But in the past, when there were no antibiotics and no hand washing stations and no soap, then an infection, if you just had a few fewer calories, it could be the difference between life and death with regards to fighting an infection. So men's meritocracy and women's egalitarian charity through force, right? Through force, you have to physically overpower the 10-year-old boy and take the food by force from his clutches, from his hand, and then you must give it to the 4-year-old girl. It always reminds me of this memory scene from Winston Smith, that there was a rare bar of chocolate and he ran to eat it on his own rather than share it with his, I think it was his sister. And this haunted him with guilt. So what I'm trying to point out is that these two, independent of each other, are interwoven and inflame the other. In other words, men can be hyper competitive specifically because women are hyper egalitarian. And women can be hyper egalitarian because men are hyper competitive. So let me give you an example. So let's say two men go out to hunt. They part in the forest, they go hunt, and then they meet up when they're coming back to their huts or teepees or whatever. And one man has 5 rabbits and one man has no rabbits. Let's make it 6 rabbits. Don't have the gross image of half a rabbit. Demi bunny. So does the woman want her man who has 6 rabbits to give 3 rabbits to the other man? Assuming that her family needs 5 rabbits a day or something like that. So you got 1 extra rabbit. Maybe she'd say, oh, give him an extra rabbit, we can make do or whatever, right? But will a woman want her husband to give food to another family and thus she and her children go hungry, as does her husband? Goes hungry, which means he's less effective at hunting the next day because he didn't get enough calories, right? So if you need to hunt, you need 2,500 calories to hunt. Let's say he only gets 1,000 calories, then he's going to have less energy for hunting the next day. And this can really produce a death spiral. Going hungry is a problem because it produces a literal death spiral, wherein the man doesn't have enough food to eat, and therefore he has less energy for hunting, less energy to chase, to hunt, he's less alert, his stomach growls and warns off the prey or something like that. And then as a result, he gets fewer rabbits, which means he has even less energy for the next day and gets, so it goes, the rabbits go 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, and then everyone dies. I mean, sort of in an extreme case, right? So if the woman were to say, give half the rabbits to the other family, and that way we're both hungry, but they're doing better, the man will say, no, these are for my kids, I'll give him the rabbit. So at least he has some food, but I can't keep giving my rabbits away so that my family starves to death. Like, we both die if I give all my rabbits away. If I give him, you know, maybe a little bit of excess, he'll have more energy for hunting, maybe have better luck tomorrow. But if he's consistently bad at hunting, then he needs to go and do something else, or work for someone else, or be a slave or a serf or something. Or maybe I'll teach him on how to be hunting better or whatever, right? So the woman can be egalitarian within her family, but being egalitarian to a stranger's family or even an enemy's family would be unthinkable. Maybe if it's her sister's family who needs, then, you know, it's still some genetics to share a little bit more or something like that. But if her husband comes home with 6 rabbits and then some stranger family comes knocking on the door and asks for three rabbits. She's probably going to say no because she cares more about her own children than the children of a stranger and so on, right? So she is able to be egalitarian because the husband is not, and the husband is able to be hyper meritocracy because his wife is not. So because she will do the redistribution, he can focus on just the pure meritocracy aspect, if that makes sense. He can focus just on pure meritocracy, knowing that his wife will be egalitarian, and she can focus on egalitarianism because she knows that her husband will be focused on meritocracy, if that makes sense, right? So I hope this, like when I was a chief technical officer, I focused on tech and the technical aspect of sales because we already had a chief financial officer who would handle the money. I didn't have to do both jobs. And if I had to do both the taxes and the finances and the tech and this, like, then I wouldn't do anything well. So basically what I'm saying is the division of labor. The division of labor. So if somebody is a brewmaster, they could become really good at becoming a brewmaster if they don't also have to become a baker. If someone is a baker and still wants beer, they don't have to focus on becoming a brewmaster. They can just focus on being a baker, of course, right? So the division of labor allows for far greater and deeper specialization. And then men specialize in meritocracy and women specialize in coercive redistribution. And it works really well. Men's disagreeableness is really important in a meritocracy. In a meritocracy, you have to be willing to be really hated and to be disagreeable to others. That's what a meritocracy is. You win, which means other people lose, which means they don't like you. Right? They don't like you. Whereas for women, cooperation is key. Men are in competition to make sure that the best spear goes to the guy with the best eye and the best throwing arm. Right? If you have three spears, you give it to the guy, or to the top three guys, let's say. The guy with the best vision has to be out there hunting and looking for a prey. And so giving the scarce resources to the best people is disagreeable to everyone else. Like Squinty Bob wants to throw the spear and people say, bro, you can't see your way out of a paper bag. Like, we're not giving you the spear. And he's mad and upset and blah, 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 right? So for women, though, parenting is more egalitarian and win-win. So the spears go to the guy with the best eyes and the best arm, the best coordination, the best throwing, because that's the way to get the most food. So it's win-lose, highly competitive, meritocratic. However, when women get together and watch each other as kids, it's not win-lose. It's win-win, right? It's win-win. The best outcome is not a meritocracy. The women don't compete on who's going to watch each other's children the best and then exclude everyone else. They watch each other's children. They help each other out, right? And of course, there's something that men do that are coordinated, like, you know, raising a barn and so on. But even still, if you have to lift something heavy, you pick the three strongest guys, not the three weakest guys. So there's still a meritocracy in all of that. But for women, you know, watch each other's kids and so on. And also, you know, hunter-gathering, like the gathering part, you know, if you're just going out and you're, you know, gathering some berries and stuff like that, it's not exactly a brutal competition, so to speak. I mean, maybe there's something if you have a good eye for finding these kinds of things and all of that, that can be helpful, but it's not a sort of brutal competition that goes on in the same way that war and hunting is and so on, right? And some meritocracy, some of the raw meritocracy elements do diminish when it comes to farming, but not in the long run. So in the long run, you want the farmer with the greenest thumb to be in control of the most land, right? People who can just coax an extra 10,000 calories out of an acre every year, you want to give them the most land. And that's what sort of what the free market did over time, was it allowed those able to bid the most for land because they could produce the most value from land to end up with the most land. So in the short run, you know, you just go out and planting stuff and harvesting stuff. I mean, some guys are better with the scythe and so on, but it's not quite the same as hunting because it's communal, right? So you got to go and plant a bunch of stuff. And maybe someone's better, you know, 10%, 20% better at planting stuff and so on. But you don't then say, well, you plant everything and everyone else can't be allowed to plant at all, right? So there's less meritocracy in the short run in farming, right? So you've got the three spears. You can only allow the three best shots to throw the spears. You can't let anyone else do it. It's not quite the same with planting and harvesting. Some people may be more efficient, but everyone needs to pitch in because it's not binary, right? If you throw the spear, either the spear brings down the deer, at least immediately, or you can chase it, or it misses completely. So it's binary, right? So you don't get a do-over. But planting and harvesting are not binary. It's not like one guy can plant the entire field perfectly and the other guy won't plant anything, right? It's just a matter of, it's a difference of degree, not of kind, right? If you throw the spear, either you get the animal or you don't. It's kind of binary. And of course, the animal has, what, 50,000 calories in it or whatever it is, right? Farming is incremental, not binary. You can be faster at it. And so the guy who's better at scything will scythe better than the guy who's not as good, but they'll both still be able to scythe. So it's, but in the long run, the civilizations or cultures that allow land to end up in the possession of those best able to maximize its productivity would win in the long run, right? So the relatively free market of land in Rome triumphed over other more collective. And, you know, one of the reasons that England was able to conquer the world was because it had a free market, more or less, certainly more than other cultures and countries, and thus had much more productivity. So males develop characteristics precisely because women balance them. If you can imagine women saying, well, Squinty Bob hasn't thrown the spear for like a week, it's definitely his turn. Well, the men would say, no, that's a bad idea. Squinty Bob shouldn't get the spear because he misses every time he throws. And that, of course, is because women, by focusing on children, are looking at the development of skills, whereas men, out hunting, are looking at the actualization or the manifestation of skills. Right? Women will say, I need to make sure my child has more food than they immediately need because they're growing, whereas an adult male will say about an adult male, he doesn't need any more food because he's finished growing. In the same way, a woman will say to a boy who's bad at throwing a ball, you should get more turns at throwing the ball so that you can figure out how to get better at it. You should practice. Whereas an adult who's looking to get someone to be part of a baseball team will say, you know, of a 20-year-old guy or a 22-year-old guy, if you don't throw the ball well, you can't be on the team because you've had plenty of time to develop the ability to throw the ball, and you haven't, therefore you are bad at throwing the ball, right? So for women, the kid who's bad at throwing the ball should get more chances to throw the ball to develop his skills. For males, as an adult, if you're bad at throwing a spear, and you're 25, you don't get to throw the spear because more practice won't help, because a man knows that the women have been encouraging the boy to throw the spear, or maybe his father did. If he's still bad at 25, like there was, I used to play baseball and soccer every Sunday with friends. Saturday was baseball, Sunday was soccer. And there was a fellow, we'll call him Bob, who was very uncoordinated. You know, he ran like it was some epileptic Geppetto with strings attached to his wrists and ankles. And he was just bad. And he was, at that point, he was 19 or 20. Now, if you're highly uncoordinated at 19 or 20, then either you're just naturally uncoordinated or you don't really care enough to practice and get better. And either way, it doesn't really matter. I mean, that's who you are, right? Whereas, of course, when you or I or anyone was a little kid and we're catching and throwing, we are uncoordinated. I still remember countless hours I spent learning how to play tennis as a kid. And I was, of course, bad at tennis at the beginning. I mean, that makes sense, right? It's a tough game to master. It's frustrating. So women are in the development of skills, which means those who are less able should get more access to resources. And it diminishes over time. In the same way that if you're in a relay race, you're going to give more coaching to the slowest person. So women, if someone's bad at something, they should get more resources. And of course, fundamentally, if you let the 4-year-old girl compete with the 10-year-old boy for food, she's going to get far fewer resources. So you need to coercively intervene to make sure she gets enough food. And the best way to do that, of course, is to bully and morally shame the boy for being selfish and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, which may work or may provoke resentment or something like that. So women have an instinct which says, if you are performing poorly, you need more resources because they're dealing with children who are growing, which is fine and is fair and is good and is right. But adult males dealing usually with adult males in a meritocracy say, if you are bad at something, you should get few or no resources. If you're bad at throwing the spears, you don't get any spears. Whereas, you know, the mother, if she's got a 5-year-old boy and a 10-year-old boy, and the 10-year-old boy is pretty good at throwing a spear, both either the father or the mother or someone is going to say, we should give more time to the 5-year-old to get him to throw spears better, right? So he's worse, so he gets more resources and more access to the spears. Whereas if he's 25 and he's throwing spears badly, he gets no access to spears or very few or whatever, right? Now, of course, what he can do is if he's 25 and he's bad at throwing spears, what he can do is he can practice all night. He can, you know, do whatever, right? But maybe it's just an eyesight thing, or maybe it is just, you know, coordination thing. Some people have bad coordination and reflexes as a whole. It's just whatever, right? So men can be meritocratic because women are egalitarian, and women can be egalitarian because men are meritocratic. And these things feed on each other. Because men are meritocratic, women have more to distribute, right? So the hunting party goes out, they get the animal because of raw meritocracy, and therefore the women have more to distribute. So women letting men be meritocratic gives women more resources to distribute, right? This is the goose that lays the golden egg kind of thing. Or it's the free market that produces all these resources that women like to redistribute, which again is fine at a sort of voluntary family level. That's totally fine. But of course, if women end up applying their egalitarian, coercive egalitarian principles to the meritocracy of men, then productivity goes down. And in the long run, you end up, like in the short run, you get more to redistribute. But in the long run, you are killing the goose that lays the golden egg, which is why, you know, there's this national debt and permanent underclass and so on, right? So on the other hand, men focus more on meritocracy because women redistribute. So a man who has to provide for his family and doesn't want to go home to his hungry wife and children empty-handed, like with no deer or rabbits or anything. So the man says, I can't afford to give Squinty Bob the spear because I need food for my family. And having his children flourish is important for his commitment to meritocracy. So women have more to redistribute if they focus on redistribution and let men be meritocratic, and men are more effective and meritocratic when they are providing resources for their women to redistribute among their children, right? So, so not to belabor the point, but I also want to make this really clear that a woman who doesn't redistribute resources is going to end up with, you know, starving and dying younger children, because the older children are going to get all the food in a scarce environment, and then that's depressing for the man, and it makes it feel like it's all kind of pointless, and that's no good, and, you know, I can't even guarantee my children are going to survive, and it's all terrible, and so on, right? And then his wife is depressed because her children are dying, so the man has much less incentive to pursue excellence and efficiency if his family is kind of falling apart, and children are dying or starving, or there's constant conflict and fighting and crying, and right? So the redistribution of the woman provides a massive incentive for the meritocracy focus and productivity of the man. I mean, how hard would you be willing to work as a man if your wife just bought a bunch of crap on Amazon and then got addicted to online gambling and blew it all? You'd be like, well, what am I working for? So the woman's efficiency has a huge effect on the man's motivation and his commitment to meritocracy. And this is a beautiful thing. This is a lovely, beautiful, wonderful, amazing, lovely thing. The problem, of course, in the modern world is that male and female, through the power of the state and voting, male and female no longer balance each other out. Women, their egalitarian principles were limited by two things. One, men saying no, and two, men being demotivated. So let's say the husband is out hunting and he goes hunting for like 12 or 14 hours. You know, he's tired, he's exhausted, and he comes home with six rabbits. And then his wife just gives all those rabbits to the neighbors. Well, his motivation collapses. And of course, we can see this, like even in places like Canada where, or other socialized medicine, when doctors hit their billing cap for the year, they just take the month off. Like the Beatles, right? When they were taxed at 95%, right? That's one for you, 19 for me. Oh, yeah, the tax man. And so if the woman is too egalitarian, then men lose their motivation to be efficient. And they're like, I don't want to go hunting. So if the woman redistributes too much, the man, well, first of all, he'll say no. And even if she bypasses him and just waits until he goes out hunting again and then just gives away all his rabbits and then his children are hungry, then he just is not motivated to go hunting. So women need to restrain their coercive egalitarianism generally to within the family, right? To within the family, to the man's kids and him. Because if she goes too far in egalitarianism, then first of all, he'll say no. And secondly, even if she bypasses that and still gives away most or all of his gains, he's just like, well, forget it. I'm not going hunting anymore. I'm not going hunting for you to just give all the rabbits to everyone else. And then that puts her survival, her flourishing, and of course, her children's survival and her children's flourishing at risk. So again, I'm trying not to labor the point too much. Really understand. Men get to be hyper meritocratic because women are coercively egalitarian, and women get to be coercively egalitarian because men are hyper meritocratic. And what's happened, of course, is that by running to the state and by money printing and debt and borrowing, in a sense, printing money through treasuries and so on, then what's happened is the cap on coercive egalitarianism has been lifted. And now women are focused on and addicted to coercive egalitarianism. And there's no limit because the men are demotivated to work. And you can see this happening in the sort of the quiet quitting and the failure to launch and the young men who, I mean, just aren't really working hard or anything like that. So the men are demotivated. Like, why would I work super hard to have my money taken from me and given to strangers? Could be a different culture, different religion, different ethnicity, whatever it is, right? These are all just additional factors, perhaps, for some, right? And it is exceedingly demotivating for men to have half their income taken from them and given to strangers. And so the cap on this in the past was that if the men get too demotivated, then there's nothing left to redistribute because they don't want to bother going hunting or anything like that. But now that the government is printing and borrowing money, there is no cap on women's hyper-egalitarianism. And that which is stopped from outside does not have a cap inside. This is really important. That which is stopped from outside does not have a cap inside. So an internal cap would be something like, I'm tired, so I should sleep. That's an internal, right? I'm full, so I should stop eating. I'm thirsty, so I should drink. I've drank too much, I should stop drinking. So those are internal, right? And that's because sometimes there are more calories available than we need. and this is particularly true, and we evolved largely in hunter-gatherer stuff, but this is particularly true when it comes to, like, you have a deer, right? Which is, 50,000 calories or 100,000. I think a human being is 100,000. I can't remember why I looked that up once, but I did. Nothing personal. But you do look tasty. But if you live by a stream, you can drink as much as you want, like assuming the stream is clean and all that, right? So you have to have a cap. So you don't just drink until you drown or something. Or I've had enough to drink. I'm good, right? I remember when I was thirsty, my brother and I found a spring in the woods in Don Mills that we used to go to get drinks because we were thirsty. I remember also when I was really thirsty, I would fill, I'm sure a lot of people do this, I would fill a sink with water and then put my whole head in it or put my whole face in it and just gulp. It was really nice. It felt very primal. And so you have to have a cap inside because there's no external cap. And so you have an external cap called pain. Like if you do things that are dangerous and you trip and fall and you jump from too high a thing and you twist your ankle or something, then there's an external cap. So that which has no internal cap is capped by external things. So if you look at the difference between sexual access for straight men versus sexual access for gay men, and of course, these are just general trends. Sexual access for straight men is quite limited. Sexual access for gay men is quite unlimited, which is why some gay men have, 100 partners a year or 50 partners a year or something like that. So in general, men seek maximum sex. And the cap that is put on is women saying no. I've heard of this. Never experienced myself directly, but I hear tales of such things, right? So there's no particular cap on male lust. I mean, obviously there's refractory periods and so on, and you just pass out after sex. You know, like that thumpy-hipped bunny who just rolls over and dies, so to speak, after sex. But there's no external practical limit to male sexuality. Now, there is, of course, practical limits on female sexuality, which is women say no, and of course it's a much higher cost for women to have sex when there's no birth control than for men to have sex and so on, right? So men, generally, when offered sex, and they're single and there's no other sort of confounding factors, will often, not always, right? Could be monks or low sex drive men or whatever, right? But will generally say yes. If an attractive woman offers sex, men will generally say yes. When an attractive man offers sex, women will not say yes to nearly as high a degree. So that makes sense. Like if you are eating Thanksgiving, right? Thanksgiving dinner, in general, a big problem is that what happens is you eat too much, and then you loosen your belt, and you lean back, you pat your belly, say, yep, that'll do it. And then you're probably, hopefully, not hungry for, 12 hours, right? So that is the way that works, and it may be even longer, right?
In 1 kilometer.
So that's what happens with that. But generally, if a woman says yes to a man for sex, he doesn't sit there and say, oh, that was great, I'm good for a week, right? So, I mean, in general, lots of men, especially when they're young, would have like sex every day or sometimes twice a day and so on, right? So the cap is women and indiscriminate sex. I'm not just talking about like sex within a marriage or whatever it is, because the honeymoon, right? People generally go at it like rabbits. So where there is no, or where there is an external limit, there's no point having an internal limit. I mean, an external limit would be something like as tall as you're going to grow, right? So as tall as you're going to grow is basically genetic, right? I think genetics, again, all other things be equal. It's 100% of your height is genetic, again, assuming you get enough food and so on, right? So 100% of your height is genetic. And so you're going to grow as tall as you're going to grow, and then your height is going to stop. And so you don't have an internal limit because there's an external limit. So there's not something that's built into your system that says, ooh, I should probably stop growing, right? I mean, most people within reason would want to be taller as a whole, and they will just work to be, eat or whatever and try to be as tall as possible. I remember Tom Woods talking about how one of the reasons he ended up slightly heavy was because he felt maybe kind of short, and he thought he'd be bigger if he looked bigger or be more intimidating, or not intimidating, because Lord knows his intellect is already intimidating enough. But there's no internal drive or limit on height, because it's external to will. And so if women have evolved with hard limits on coercive egalitarianism or coercive redistribution, if women have evolved with hard limits on that, which is the limits, it's tripartite, right? The limits of just there aren't enough resources, you can't get 50 rabbits a day, number one. Number two, men saying no to their redistribution. And number three, men losing motivation if women give away too much of their hard-earned resources. A man is not going to work very hard to plant and grow crops if his wife just gives them all away. Like, she's going to harm her survival. So because there have been external limits on women's coercive egalitarianism, forced redistribution, whatever you want to call it, because there have been external limits, internal limits have not evolved for women when it comes to redistribution. They will always find something else to redistribute to. Because women evolved for maximum redistribution because it was limited by male motivation, resource availability, and men just saying no. So you do the maximum of what you can get away with. In the same way, male sexuality has evolved in general to get the maximum sex and to some degree the maximum variety, because men had to repopulate during a time of war and things like that. When a lot of men got killed, men would have to repopulate, and therefore variety would not be. Men who were averse to variety could not repopulate the tribe after a decline in the number of men. So men have evolved for maximum sex. We're all man whores at heart, right? So men have evolved for maximum sex because the limitation has been externalized to women saying no. And so when women say no to sex until you're married, then the maximum sex a man can get is through marriage, and therefore men will commit to marriage. If men can get variety and sexual access without marriage, well, we can see what happens, right? We can see what happens. So when you use the power of the state to take away any male limitation on coercive redistribution for women, women will just, it's like a tumor, right? Not women are like a tumor, but this particular drive or desire. A tumor is cells that grow without rational restraint or productive restraint. And women's desire for coercive redistribution is an addiction because all of the caps have been removed. Women can redistribute to strangers, to Africa, to anybody who's poor. They can redistribute anywhere and everywhere, and no internal cap has been developed for that, because what's the point of developing an internal cap when an external cap is continually deployed? In other words, you will aim for the maximum possible redistribution until your husband says no, or you run out of resources, or his motivation collapses because you're giving away too much, in which case you pull it back, and right? So women will strive for maximum redistribution. And when the caps are removed, it looks crazy, but it's not. It's not. Now, this also applies to hypergamy. Hypergamy, which is women's desire to trade up, women's desire to get the maximum quality man that she can get, which I have no problem with hypergamy. It's one of the reasons my brain is big, your brain is big, and so on, is because women constantly wanted more intelligent men, more productive men, more successful men. And so hypergamy is a beautiful thing, and women have not developed an internal cap to hypergamy, because the cap in general was external. So during the very short dating phase from like 16 to 18, again, it's just whatever, right? I mean, but generally it was a 6 month, maybe 6 to 12 months, you had to choose a guy. And I've sort of mentioned this before, so I'll keep it brief, of course. But women, you know, there's a woman who's a 6, and of course all the women want the 10. But because we have monogamy, the women can't get the 10. And the reason that we have monogamy is that harem style Genghis Khan, you know, one alpha and then 20 females or 10 females, is unstable because the 19 men who are there with no access to a mate have every incentive to kill off the alpha or to side with invaders and so on, right? Which is why, you know, putting all of these unmarried and largely unmarriable men into societies is obviously, I mean, it's destabilizing, not by accident, but by design. So women aim for the maximum, of course, right? However, there is a cap on the maximum. So let's say there's a 6 and she wants a 10. But the man who's a 10 wants a woman who's a 10. And let's say that you have to marry the woman in order to get sex, which is, you know, throughout most of Western history, that's kind of the way that it was. So in order to get sex, you have to marry the woman. The 10 man does not want to marry the 6 woman. And I'm not just talking looks. It's a variety of things. Intelligence, status, poise, elegance, musical ability, and social skills, conversational skills, whatever, right? It could be the quality of a family, whether she's wealthy or poor, you know, all kinds of things, right? So I'm just talking generally desirability or quality. So a man who's a 10 doesn't want a 6. And if the 6 goes for the 10, she's going to fail, and she's also going to look foolish. She's going to look foolish because she cannot judge herself. Like if somebody says, oh, I'm a fantastic singer, and you go to karaoke and they sound like a cat being dragged ass backwards through a thorny bush, then, you know, they look foolish. They look unwise and, you know, would probably not be, I mean, if they can't even judge the quality of their own singing voice, then they are not going to judge things too well as a whole. They lack humility, they lack realism, and so on. So if a 6 goes for a 10, then she's going to look foolish. And the 6 men won't want her as much because A, she looks foolish, she's making bad decisions, she doesn't understand where she stands in the hierarchy. And also, they recognize that if the 6 woman goes for the 10 man, then she's going to view herself as regretfully, pitifully, sadly, dejectedly settling for a mere 6, even though she's a 6. Right? If the fat woman thinks she can get the athletic man, then another overweight man who might be a good partner for her will realize that she will be very sad and unhappy to condescend to marry an overweight man, even though she's obese. So if the 6 goes for the 10, she probably can't get a 6 anymore. And also, of course, the 6s are pairing off with each other. So if she goes for the 10, she might be able to get a 3 or a 4. So if you aim too high, you end up with less. And that's the limit on hypergamy. And of course, before birth control and with monogamy, women like desperately needed men to be their providers because, you know, they had 3 or 4 kids and, you know, they didn't have all of the labor-saving devices. And so women desperately needed men to be providers, which is why women cheated less or at least kept it under wraps. So women desperately need men to be providers, and a woman who gambles and aims too high and ends up with less is doing a disservice to her bloodline. Because a woman who's a 5, or let's say, no, sorry, let's go back to a woman who's a 6, you know, cute. Not pretty, not gorgeous, but cute. So a woman who's a 6 is a 6 because her ancestors' looks matched. Now, if a woman aims for a 10 but gets a 4, her child will be a 5. And so the bloodline has gone from 5 to 4 because of her greed. And I'm not saying that people chart this out. It's kind of an instinct, if that makes sense. And she doesn't want to take her entire bloodline and go from a historical 6, which has been the result of thousands and thousands of years of reasonably good decisions to maintain the 6. She doesn't want to take it down by marrying a 4 and producing children who are 5s. Now, of course, every woman has the fantasy that she's ordinary, but the 10 is completely infatuated by her, right? This is the Bridget Jones fantasy. This is the Anastasia Steele, was that the cheesy name from 50 Shades of Grey? This is the fantasy that the 10, the man who's a 10, is going to become obsessed with her, although she's a five, and then she's going to have kids who are eights or nines if some of the stuff can be transferred, right? If it's just looks, it's going to be genetic. If it's just intelligence, it's going to be genetic to a large degree. But if it's money, the money can be inherited. So every woman has this fantasy, and it is a very toxic fantasy. It is a very dangerous fantasy in the same way that, you know, men have the sexy librarian fantasy, like the woman who's just not that attractive. But boy, she takes off her glasses and puts her hair down and dresses nicely, and she's a stunning goddess or whatever it is, right? It's a great line from Stanley Kowalski in A Streetcar Named Desire. I never got into complimenting women on their looks. I mean, I never met a woman yet who didn't know exactly how attractive she was. And I'm telling you, man, some women give themselves credit for way more than they've got. It's a powerful line. I mean, Tennessee Williams, the writer, was floridly gay. He even talked about golden showers in a book later on. He was floridly gay. And he said, Blanche DuBois is me. I read his biography many years ago. So hypergamy used to be limited by aim high, but don't aim too high, because if you aim too high, you get less. Like, if you completely lowball a house offer, let's say a house is on sale for $500,000 and you offer $200,000, they're not going to deal with you anymore. You're not going to get the house. And then they're going to deal with people who offer 475 or 450 or whatever it is, right? Or maybe if there's a bidding war, somebody who offers 550 or 600,000. And so if you lowball, they're not going to take you seriously. They're not going to deal with you, and you're not going to get the house, most likely. And you're certainly not going to get the house for 200,000 or 250 or even three. So if you completely lowball, you don't get the house. I mean, could it conceivably happen? Sure, but I mean, it's not what you'd ever bet on. I guess theoretically it could happen, right? I mean, it would be like me entering some elite golf tournament. It's like, could I win? I'm not a golfer, mini golfer, but not a golfer. Could I win? I mean, it's theoretically possible. I could just randomly whack the ball and get a whole bunch of holes in ones. And like, I mean, but it's not anything you'd bet on, right? It's not anything that you would plan on. And it would be a waste of time in general, a waste of everyone else's resources. So what used to be the cap on hypergamy was if you aim too high, you end up with less. In the same way, when your kids, you know, if you've ever gone on one of those walls that goes up and up and up, you know, and then you're like, it becomes cool to see who can jump from the highest, and you get more status from jumping from a higher part of the wall. I mean, I think it's a boy thing, right? So, and so you can go to the very tallest part of the wall, but you're almost certainly going to break your ankle. So you want the status, but if you aim too high, you get an injury, you get laughed at, you get mocked, jokes are made about it for years, and you actually end up with less status by aiming too high, and pain. And so for a woman, if she aims too high, she may end up with a much lower, she probably will end up with a much lower status male or no male at all. And so if you aim too high, right, the six really digs in and aims for the 10 and hangs around him and tries to charm him and sends him flowers and whatever, right? So the six aims for the 10, and then she doesn't get the 10 or a 9 or an 8 or whatever it is, because she looks kind of ridiculous. And then, you know, the fours and the threes are pairing off, and she just may end up like only the ones and twos are left by the time she emerges from this delirium of getting the 10, right? And then she might find it unbearable to get with a, you know, fat, pimply, bald, ugly guy with a squinty eye and a gammy leg, right? Like a limp. She may be just like, you know what? No, absolutely not. And then her by aiming too high, her entire bloodline ends. Not like her bloodline absolutely ends, and she ends up with no protector, no provider. She can't even have sex, you know, because it's too risky. I mean, maybe she end up as a prostitute or something like that. I mean, sorry, she can't have sex on a regular basis because you're going to get pregnant. No abortions. So I don't know what did they use sheep's bladder condoms or whatever it was, right? I don't know what prostitutes did to avoid getting pregnant throughout the history. But, or maybe they were just sterile to begin with, I don't know. but her bloodline is mostly going to end. Or even if, you know, she gets pregnant as a prostitute or as a single woman, her kid's going to be a bastard and rejected by society, so the bloodline ends just one generation removed, right? I know so many single sons of single mothers who never got together with a woman. For a single mother to have a single son is mostly or highly likely to end the bloodline anyway, just one generation removed. So, because they have to become hypermasculine to balance the overwhelming femininity of the mother, they almost have to become a caricature of masculinity. So hypergamy was limited by women who aimed too high, lost out, or ended their bloodlines. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't aim higher. It doesn't mean that if you're a 6, you can't get a 7. But remember, the 7 is looking for a 7. And so you have to bring something else to the table as a woman or a man to compensate for the missing point. And of course, since the end of monogamy and the provision of birth control and abortions, neither of which prevent 1 in 4 American women from being transmitted with a, like having a permanent, incurable sexually transmitted disease, usually herpes, or I think half of black women have herpes or something like that. I mean, it's kind of gross. Not the black women, but the herpes thing. So for women, once pair bonding and marriage as a requirement for sex has been removed or lifted, then women can gain access to a more attractive male or a higher status male by offering sex. And they will get sex, they will not get commitments, which is why you get ghosting and situationships and women going crazy with the, he's just not that into you. There was a famous scene in Sex and the City. I think it produced an entire book, which was, you know, maybe he's just not that into you. Or he's just not that into you, right? A man who's into you will fight tooth and nail to spend time with you. Like once I met my wife, we spent pretty much every day together until we got married, and we spent pretty much every day together since, and a lot of time with each other. And it's great. So I just wanted to mention that hypergamy is another one of these things that does not have an internal cap free of consequences. So a woman will be interested in a 10, let's say she's a 6, and she's interested in a 10, and things don't, for whatever reason, fall past the classic quarterback head cheerleader combination. And let's say that she can get a guy several points higher for some particular reason. And it, the reason could be shallow and, you know, whatever, open to criticism. Let's say he's a guy who's really drawn to a great butt, and let's say that she has a great butt. Right. So then that would be an example of her being able to go up a point or two just because of physical attributes. Or maybe he absolutely loves music and she was born with a great singing voice and you know, back in the day when you couldn't put records on or things like that. So she might go up. She might go up. Maybe she's born with a truly even temper and a pleasant demeanor and even and just soft voiced and all of that, and just really agreeable. And maybe that just has really worked out well in terms of her being able to get a higher quality male. Maybe, you know, all of her sisters who are equally attractive are shrill and loud and aggressive and all of that kind of stuff. And maybe she's just sweet and all of that. So again, it might be. So she might be able to go up, not just based on looks. I don't know why I said I'm not just including looks, but let's just say that, there are things that could happen that get her up. So women get her up a notch or two. And so a woman can absolutely go up. So she should not be limited in her desire or her drive to go up. That should be totally fine. She should be open to that opportunity, but it's rare. And she should try that. And then if it doesn't end up working, she should, of course, be humble and all of that kind of stuff and make sure that she doesn't end up in this kind of stuff. So that's really what's happened in the relations between the sexes and so on. And I think it's a real shame. I think it's quite sad, but it does seem to be what's going on. And of course, this is just the natural result of coercion between the sexes. That which is coercive has no cap. That which is coercive has no particular cap, except other violence. And of course, men can't exactly fight back against the state and restore the balance. But this is why a free society, a free market society, would be fantastic for everyone and produce a life of balance and happiness and love and all of that stuff, which would be great for children, because really the real cost of all of this is on children. freedomain.com/donate. Thank you so much, my friends. Have a beautiful afternoon. We'll talk soon. Bye.